examples, showing you the nature of the kinds of cases that we decide in these areas and why you have to know something from abroad, that might cast a little light on the broader question of what are the challenges that interdependence faces us with. What is interdependence? What's that about? So I don't promise a global answer to that question, but I do promise, like looking through a telescope at something, that you might begin to get some ideas by looking at how it affects one institution, our institution.
You know, I love the story that you talk about in the book about the student from Cornell, because you're in Texas, we have lots of entrepreneurs here, and certainly that student at Cornell was a budding entrepreneur. Share with our audience about how that worked its way up to your office.
Well, I have gone through in this book a sort of breaking down area by area, and for the most part, people become very interested in this conflict between security and civil rights, terrorism, and also certain efforts to give people remedies for civil rights violations, the Alien Tort Statute, and even marriage. There are a lot of international things and family, but you're right that a lot of it is commerce, and that commerce is not going to go away. And so I get a case one day. It's a student from Cornell. He's from Thailand. And he discovered that his textbooks, which are pretty expensive in the United States, the same textbook in English is on sale in Bangkok for a lot less money. So he writes his parents and says, send me a few. No, they sent more than a few, and he began to have a nice little thing going up there in Cornell. And the publisher got annoyed and brought a lawsuit. So we're deciding this lawsuit, and the answer as to whether he has the right to do it is in a few words in the copyright law, our copyright law. And a real genius wrote those words who was intent on making certain nobody could understand what he was talking about. I mean, this is impossible. Now, I go into my office, and I see, normally, I have we maybe have 10 to 20 briefs in a case. The petitioner side, respondents, the government might file a brief, and anyone can file a brief. You can file a brief. They're called amicus curiae briefs. File a brief. And maybe we'll get about 10 or 15 of these briefs, or maybe 20. They're not brief either. It's really annoying. But still, I go into my office, a stack like this. I say, well, that's amazing. What, this is, I mean, it's an interesting case, but I mean, really, what? Thailand, Britain, Holland, lawyers all over the world are filing briefs in this case. And I don't figure out why exactly until they were good briefs, but I get down to two-thirds of the way through the stack, and one of the briefs says that copyright today is no longer a question of film or books or music. Try buying a car. The car has lots of software. The software is copyrighted. Try going into any store you want. Look at the shelves. The goods have labels. The labels are copyrighted. And he ends up by saying, your answer to the question posed in this case is going to affect $3.2 trillion worth of commerce. Trillions of dollars is a lot of money, even today.
Even in Texas.
Yes, even in Texas. I wasn't sure about Texas. I didn't want to add that last part. But I suspect maybe that's so. And that's why. And the student eventually won, but that's not the point. The point is, I can tell you a similar story in antitrust. We have a plaintiff in Ecuador, distributes vitamins. He says there's a cartel. The cartel's in Holland. He sues him in New York. Why New York? I thought, well, maybe he's too weak. The price is too high. You know, he can't take his vitamins. He can only get to New York. That isn't really the reason. The reason possibly is treble damages. Can he bring a lawsuit under our law? Again, briefs from all over the world there, including the EU. It explains, don't let him do this. You will wreck our system of antitrust enforcement. Same thing with securities law. Plaintiff, Australia, buys shares, Australian company. Where in Australia? Sold where in the Australian exchange? But the claim is that this Australian company bought a company in Florida and they lied about how much money they had and therefore it was a fraud. Can they bring that case in New York? Briefs from all over the place, securities authorities, again Europe, saying don't let them do it. It will interfere with our whistleblower efforts. It'll interfere a lot. Don't do it. And we ended up not doing it. I thought if I'd gone back to my law school days and read Henry Friendly, he would have come to a different conclusion, I think. Really interesting, because he was a great judge. And I thought the reason is the world's changed. The world's changed. He said that Luxembourg would welcome our efforts to apply our securities law to a company that did business primarily there and in Europe. They wouldn't welcome that right now. And what we have to do with this magic legal word called comity, that is a really technical word. And all I can tell you about the virtue of that word comity in its technical aspect is no one knows what it means. Nobody. No judge knew nobody. All right. But nonetheless, when you're applying it in a case, it has something to do with trying to get things to sort of work out and not interfere too much with another nation. Today, in case after case, it means taking laws and enforcement institutions and other bodies in many different countries and trying to see that they work together in harmony, meshing them. That's slightly different, but really quite different, a task for a judiciary. You say, don't do it? Oh, what a mess. And a mess that will affect not just their law, but our law too, and will certainly affect American businesses that must do business in more than one country. So I'm giving examples.
Let's talk about security. You talk about how the world has changed. How do you balance, now that terrorism is truly a threat, how do you strike a reasonable balance between liberty and security? And before you answer that, or tell us where you were on 9/11.
Oh, in 9/11, I was in India. Sandra O'Connor and I had gone there for a meeting with Indian judges, and we were discussing ADR, alternative dispute resolution, various other things, and there it was. We were in a restaurant and had a television set, and there we saw it. And the Chief Justice of India said, don't go home. I phoned, my children were okay. Stay here and let's continue the meetings. We won't have any big parties or anything, but stay here. And the judges there, the lawyers, everyone we met were incredibly sympathetic and incredibly nice. And I'd say we came away from that thinking that the main divisions in the world are not really racial or geographical or national. The main divisions are really between those who believe in a rule of law as a way of solving human problems and those who don't. And we're on the first side. And it's not clear, who wins this and how much and so forth, but that's the important thing. That's when you wanted me to go into the other.
And now, how do you balance security versus...
Okay, I have another question I have a question I'd sort of like to ask them, but I can do it later on...
You're the judge, go ahead.
Well, we were talking about commerce. And I just wonder how many, this shows a problem that I think will come up and shows you how international these things are. Think of an organization, it's such a big group that I can't resist asking this question. Look, how many organizations, there are organizations in the world, go back to treaties. All right, treaties used to be, but primarily, us in England, us in France, end the war, whatever it is. Okay, more and more treaties today are multilateral treaties where what they're doing is setting up an organization. And that organization consists of a bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy makes rules. And the rules may bind business or individuals from more than one nation. International Trade Organization, good example. Okay, now, Professor Cassese had his law students go out and do a study of this question I'm going to ask you. Think of my definition. May not be a treaty, maybe an executive agreement, maybe some kind of agreement. Organization, treaty, rules or regulations thereunder, binding citizens or businesses of more than one nation. Have you got the picture? Okay. How many in the world do you think there are? Now, I'll say, how many think there are more than 20? Oh, yeah, of course. More than 100? No, that's right. More than 500? More than 1,000? More than 2,000? This is a very informed group.
Do you get there?
Are more than 2,000. Yep. There are more than 2,000. And we belong ourselves probably to 800 or 900 of them. I had my research assistants check that out. I mean, they're all over the place. I mean, we've heard of the ITO. How many of you have heard of the Bluefin Whale Commission? Some? All right, what about the International Olive Oil Council? Yeah, not everybody. Not everybody's heard of the International Olive Oil Council. But they're here, and they're all over the place, these organizations. Baal. What about the meetings that are held in Baal? Who goes to Baal? Securities regulators from the SEC, banks. What do? They sit down and they discuss what the rules and regs should be. They don't really enact them. All they do is send the SEC staff back, and then the SEC enacts them. That's all. And some people complain, I'm not saying who's right, that, hey, this rule was made in Baal, and we didn't have a chance to participate. No notice and comment in Baal. You give us notice and comment now, please, the decision's already made. Oh, just sitting there waiting for us. Or, try this, which we came close to. Fabulous case. Luckily, we didn't get the issue. I mean, we avoided it. What was an unbelievable case. Can I give them a little background? Okay, this is the case. A woman in Ohio, I think it was, gets a little annoyed at her best friend because her best friend was about to have a baby and the woman's husband was the father. Okay, this was not a good situation. So what she did, since she worked in a camera shop, is she got a chemical which would make you itch, and she put it on the doorknob of the best friend. Well, the best friend comes out, and unfortunately what she didn't know is it all turns red when it gets on a doorknob. So she thought there was something odd about the doorknob, and she never touched it. Well, she touched it a little, and it caused her a problem. So she tells the postal, before you know it, the U.S. Department of Justice is prosecuting her for violation of the Chemical Weapons Treaty. And we are supposed to decide whether under this Chemical Weapons Treaty, Congress can be given authority to enact criminal laws that it wouldn't otherwise have the authority to enact. Quite a theoretical question, but related, we've avoided that. But I'm just showing you, they're creeping up on us. Creeping up on us. What? Exactly the same kinds of questions that the Europeans have answered. I mean, look, EU, they have treaties. German Constitutional Court, Italian Constitutional Court, Austrian Constitutional Court, all have to say, does our Constitution give the government the power to delegate lawmaking authority to this body over here called the EU? And they all say the same thing, not complete. No, we reserve some under our Constitution. They never found one that was reserved, but nonetheless, you see the principle? All right, now, let's imagine, and I don't think we have to go far to imagine, that environmental problems, health problems, safety problems, commercial problems, terrorism problems, that all of these affect more than one nation. That all of them, if we can make any dents at all, will require some kind of cooperation. And to what extent can Congress delegate to some other body like that the authority to make something that binds some of us? If you say no, zero, how? How do we, in fact, produce bits of rule of law, bits and pieces, that can help us deal with these problems? If you say yes, the sky's the limit, what happened to Article 1? Article 1 of this document says that the legislative power is given to Congress, vested in a Congress, not the International Olive Oil Council. I don't think. You see? That's the problem they faced in Europe. And they struggled to find answers to that. Now, I'm just using that because I want to show you something. These are not some, this book is not about some esoteric thing that's sort of like a corner of the law. It is about something that is right in front of our eyes. And we see it all over the place. And of course it will give rise to very serious, very important legal questions. And my point is, we better be prepared. We don't have to have the answers. We don't know the answers yet. But they're coming, and that is a reason.
Let me ask you, this morning I received this email, or a copy of an article from several people, and it is a situation where the United States is, in fact, an outlier. And this is, the headline was, "Once Again, Justice Breyer Presses Case Against Death Penalty." You have been quite out front in writing your dissents on the death penalty. Tell us how your philosophy has evolved, and why do you think it is something where we should perhaps listen to other countries?
Well, two separate things. I did write a dissent. It was fairly long. It was 46 pages, but who counts? But the point was, I wanted to gather evidence and information, an argument which I thought tended to show. I didn't say it should be abolished. It leaned in that direction, but I said we should reconsider the question. And the argument was basically, we go back to the turn of the 20th century, probably there were about 100 people being executed a year. This year there will be 19, so it's pretty rare. I thought, the reason I wrote this so long, I didn't want it to be, oh, he thinks it. I wanted to be, look, here are a few facts for you to examine. I'm not saying it matters that I think it. It matters to a degree, but not overwhelmingly. It matters what you think. And so I want the people who read this to say, oh, pretty interesting, etc. Well, in the 46 pages, to get back to where you started, I put two pages in that had to do with other countries. Most of them do not have the death penalty. But that's a minimal part of this opinion, and it's deliberately minimal. If the fact that other countries do not have it, but China does, they count for a large part of the world's population. And if it helps to convince you that we should re-examine the death penalty, fine. But I put two pages in because I thought a lot of people are not going to be convinced by this argument. And I don't mind, because I have many other facts and arguments and bases here for coming to the conclusion. So if it helps to convince you, fine. And if it doesn't, there are still 44 pages to go.
The court has not been at full strength for a number of months. How has that affected your work?
We take about probably 70 to 80 cases a year. As I said, we're taking cases almost exclusively on the basis that the lower courts have come to different conclusions on the same question of federal law. That's what Taft said when he was president. After President of the United States, he was Chief Justice of the Court. He said, it is not the job of this court to engage in error correction. Everyone here has already had a trial, an appeal, maybe more than one. And anyway, we couldn't. I mean, maybe the lower courts are right. Too many cases. Well, what is your job? Create uniform federal law. Look at instances where it's not uniform. Different judges, different conclusions. Now they need us. All right, now you see that's basically, almost exclusively, what we're doing. There's some other things. If someone says a law of Congress is unconstitutional, we'll hear it if a lower court holds that. But in any case, you see what we're doing. All right, say 70 to 80 cases a year. About half are unanimous. You wouldn't know that from reading the newspaper, but they are. The 5-4s are about 20%. Not always the same 5 and same 4 either. So I looked back at one point, a year before Nino died, which is sad because we miss him a lot. He's a good colleague, he's a good friend. We look back the year before he died. I think there were 4 or 5 cases, possibly, where his vote made a difference to the result. Since he died in February, And between February and the end of the term in March, I think, don't hold me to this number exactly, but I think there were four cases that were split 4-4. If we're split 4-4, it's as if we never took the case. And the lower court decision simply stands. There were four. Two of them, I would say, were high-button cases, going to be on the front page of the paper. Two were very technical and probably would be nowhere. Obituary column, I don't know. But and that's what the result was. That's what the result was. And, of course, as you go longer in time, there will be more such cases. But that's the state of the art.
So when the new judge comes on, hopefully within a few months, what advice would you give him or her?
Well, I said before, stay calm. I know what you're thinking. Everyone does the same. You get appointed to the Supreme Court. To be appointed a federal judge, lightning has to strike. And to be appointed a judge of the Supreme Court, it has to strike twice in the same place. And everybody knows that. And everybody on the court knows it double. And so the first thing that happens, Justice Douglas said this, Justice Souter said this, everyone has the same experience. Oh, my God. I mean, can I really do this? I sure as hell thought I could. I was glad to be appointed. But, oh, my goodness, I mean, there is no other place to go. How will I do it? Will I do something absolutely idiotic? And you go around rather worried about that for a while. But as they also said, common experience after 3 years. Douglas said after 3 years the court cases begin to repeat. He didn't mean literally repeat, but you've seen the area. You've gotten some ideas on the area. You've gotten sort of certain basic principles about it. So it becomes easier that way. And also you gain a little bit of confidence. I'm not saying the confidence is, oh, I've done this so well. The confidence is, well, somebody has to do this. They decided I would do it, and I'm going to do my best. And that is what people remain with. I mean, it is a job, which is lucky as you get along older. It is a lucky thing. You have to give your best all the time. You can't really let up. And you say, oh, that must be hard. No, it's actually an advantage. Keeps you busy.
And, let me ask
and
you.
It's a good thing. David Souter said, you know, you're always on duty. That's true. That's true. And that's an asset, probably. That's an asset.
Well, we have an interesting question from a student at Mitz High School, Peyton Broussard, 12th grade. Many argue that judges should take into account personal experience upon making decisions. What do you think about this? And if so, how do you maintain a balance between judging with your own personal experience versus interpreting the Constitution?
There's a sense in which it's true and a sense in which it's not. It's not true that if, for example, you've had some personal experience, like on a jury, where, say, a member of your family was assaulted, and then you're going to judge somebody in an assault case. You better be careful of that, because people can generalize to instances where, really, they're quite different. And so beware of that kind of personal experience. But where I think the personal experience comes in is when I will get the criticism that I think is our biggest threat. The biggest threat to us, and there undoubtedly there is this thought somewhere in the minds of most of you. What is the court really? Well, really it's just all politics. Really it's a group of junior league, junior varsity politicians. That's what they really are. And I run into that a lot. And of course it's there, and if you're only going to read the high-button issue in the newspapers, you'll double think that. So I say, no, that isn't so. And then my audience, particularly the younger ones, I like talking to the students, that they go, hey, they are not respecters of persons. You've got to give them a straight answer. They'll say, yep. I say, I see. You think I'd say that even if it weren't true? Yep, that's what we think, all right. So I say, okay, look, how can I explain this? I worked in the Senate. I was chief counsel. I worked for Senator Kennedy. He was the chairman. I said politics was all over the place. Politics was, hey, where are the votes? Where are the votes? Who's popular? Are the Dems coming or the reps? I mean, how do we get them together on this? Who's popular? What's the right position in this? What's the popular position on this? And so forth and so on. They're all mixed up. That kind of politics I do not see. I haven't seen in 22 years. So then they immediately say, well, what about Bush v. Gore? So I say, I think I could convince you even on that one, but it would take me an hour, so I'm not going to try. But consider that as okay, an exception if you want. I don't think it is, but nonetheless. Ah, we didn't really mean politics. Not in that sense. We meant ideology. Oh, you mean, am I a Marxist troublemaker? Or am I an Adam Smith free enterpriser? I say, if I find myself writing an opinion on that kind of basis of what is generally at that abstract level good for the country, forget it. That isn't the job. I'm not doing the right thing. I cannot promise you it never happens, but it shouldn't. And people try not to have that happen. But there is a third thing, and this is where the question is highly relevant. I mean, we all are who we are. And by the time you reach a certain age, the fact that I grew up in San Francisco and went to Lowell High School, and there's somebody here who went to Lowell High School, too. He introduced himself to me. He's great. It's a good high school. It's a good public high school in San Francisco. That's where I was. And I grew up right in the city. And I went to Stanford, and I've had the life I've had, you know. And so have we all. And, of course, that helps us. It shapes us. It means on certain very broad, relevant philosophical questions, if we're lawyers, we'll have views at some abstract level. What is this document really about? What's law about? What's the relation of law to the people of this country? What's the country about? What's it like? And people do have views on those kinds of things. To what extent should we try most of the time to make black letter rules? To what extent are we prepared to live with a legal mess? Just choosing examples. I'm an example of the latter and Nino Scalia the former. That's a philosophical view about how to proceed in law. And sure, there's that. You can't escape that. You can't escape it. And you shouldn't escape it. Law is not the result of computer programming. It is not feed it into the computer, you get the answer out. Absolutely not. It is a human institution designed to produce benefits for human beings, and we are one part of that big human institution. And of course, we're not going to escape that background. And I used to think, oh, isn't it awful? Here I am, I grew up in San Francisco, lived in Cambridge, Mass. For a long time, and thought, I'd seen a lot of disagreement, but nothing till I went to Washington. And first I thought, isn't it too bad that everybody doesn't agree with me? It was so... And then I began to think, no, it's not too bad. It's a big country. There are 320 million people. There are a lot of different points of view. My mother used to say that. She said, there isn't any view so crazy there isn't somebody here who doesn't hold it. And, well, there we are. And this document has held them together through thick and thin. There's been a lot of thin. There's been a civil war. There's been segregation. There's been goodness knows what. But we've stuck together. And okay, people have somewhat different philosophies on this. 9-member Supreme Court, fine. Not a problem. Maybe even an advantage. And we do get on well, personally. We always have. I've never heard a word raised in voice raised in anger or a word said about anybody else that was insulting, not even as a joke in that conference. Got on well, irrespective of the disagreement about the issue. So I think it's okay.
What did you learn working with Senator Kennedy?
I told you the one thing.
We talked about that this morning.
I know what he's thinking. I thought this was interesting. I've used this a lot. I've learned many things. I loved working for him. I really liked it. He made it fun. I mean, he really did. He was serious, but he made it fun. He was interested in helping, but he made it fun. But come in, and one of the things he'd tell us, Ken Feinberg and I, we'd worked on all kinds of things with the Republicans and with others, and very often we'd reach agreement. He said, credit, his compromise is not... Hey, I'll go halfway here and you go halfway there. He says, that's not a compromise. A compromise is this. You listen to the other person. Oh, you hear something. Now, that's not a bad idea. What a good idea you had. Let's see if we can't work with this. And then you work with that idea and you get something you both can live with. And afterward, he said, by the way, if this thing doesn't work, who wants credit? And if it does work, there'll be plenty of credit to go around. Don't worry. Credit is a weapon. Credit is a weapon to give to someone else to further your objective. You see? You're getting the idea? And when that press conference was there, and it's Kennedy and, say, Senator Hatch or somebody else who disagreed with him, it's the other person gets pushed out front. He had a really good idea over here, a really good idea. And we were able to work with that and produce results. So I would say after a few years there, that's what I learned about compromise. I can't say I'm always perfect at practicing that, nor is anyone. But that, I think, is the right direction.
Well, let's see if we have some questions from the audience. If you'd raise your hand, and let me remind you, we're looking for questions. And as we move towards there, let me ask you one that came from the audience. And it gets back to the question that I'm not sure if you answered when I was talking about liberty and security. No. In an environment of globally connected information, the First Amendment values often come into conflict with international restrictions on hate speech, terrorist recruitment efforts, etc. To what extent should U.S. courts be involved in attempts to enforce speech-based judgments such as Google, Facebook, Twitter?
That's a good question.
That came from Brian Holland. Thank you, Brian.
It's a good question. It'll take a minute. I can tell you where we are generally, in my opinion, where we are. You go back to Cicero. That's where you have to go back. Cicero said something great. I can't really get it exactly right because it's in Latin. But he said, basically, I used to translate it as this. I said, when the cannons roar, the laws fall silent. Actually, someone told me the Romans didn't have cannons, so that rather wrecked that whole translation. But nonetheless, a time of war, forget about law. Now, countries, including the United States, followed that principle for an awfully long time. Try the Sedition Act, John Adams. People put in jail, courts didn't do anything. Try the Civil War. Lincoln, of course, had a pretty big problem. But Seward one day calls in the British ambassador and says, see that bell there? He's the Secretary of State. See that bell? I can push it once, put anyone I want in prison. And they did. Tens of thousands. Not in the army either. Not in any army. He says, I push it twice, put anyone I want in Indiana in jail. Tell me, he said. Does the Queen of England have such power? The court got involved, our court, said he couldn't do things sort of like that after the war was over. Not at the time. That's easy. After the war is over. And First World War, read sometime about the history of Woodrow Wilson and your First Amendment that you're talking about. Or go to World War II, and my mother used to drive down with her to Tan Fran Racetrack, south of San Francisco, and she said that's where they kept the Japanese at the beginning of World War II. Indeed, 70,000 American citizens of Japanese origin, who had done nothing wrong whatsoever, were taken from their homes on the West Coast and moved to camps in the Intermountain area, prison camps. Mm-hmm. One of them, Fred Korematsu, I met him once. He was at the house of our next door neighbor, she used to be Ann Bezig. Her father was a head of the ACLU in Northern District of California. He used to play poker with my father. But he represented Korematsu, and the ACLU wouldn't sign the brief. Interesting. But remember, it's a few months after Pearl Harbor. And they think California might be invaded. But in any case, the ACLU came in later in the case. But he's sure he's going to win. He says, I'm an American. I haven't done anything wrong, which he hadn't. No, it got to the Supreme Court in 44. There is no risk of invasion in 44. 6-3. 6-3. Government wins. Despite the fact that the Justice Department had written a brief through circumstances too long to go into, they discovered this is total fake. I mean, they called in the FCC and said, DeWitt says that there are 763 instances of signaling. Is that so? And the FCC comes back with a stack like this. It's not one. Not one? By the way, how'd you do this work? So they were all buck privates. They didn't know how to work the machinery. How did you get this information so quickly? Oh, we did it at the time. We showed it to DeWitt at the time. So they say, I'm not signing the brief. And they call in Herbert Wexler to write a footnote they can agree to. And they wrote, the footnote was like that copyright thing, you know. I mean, it was pretty obscure. But if you read it carefully, I thought the court never read it. No, Charlie Horsky, representing the Japanese American Defense League, says to the court in oral argument, read the footnote. They read it. 6-3 against Korematsu. And you can find in Frankfurter's memoirs that conference day where Black, the six were Black, Douglas, Frankfurter, I mean, people who signed Brown versus Board. I mean, they were the liberals. And they Black goes into that conference, and he says, well, somebody has to run this war, Roosevelt or us, and it can't be us. No, it's Roosevelt. There we are. Sky's the limit. Jump to Guantanamo. Somewhat different attitude. Four of the people incarcerated bring suits that come to us. These are not the four most popular people in the United States. Bin Laden's chauffeur is not the most popular person in the United States. They are suing very high-level officials, and one of their claims, they won all four. They won all four. One of them is Congress just passed a law saying we can't go to court. It's unconstitutional. We said, yeah, it is. It is unconstitutional. They have to give you habeas corpus. Sandra O'Connor wrote the words that are the answer to that question. The Constitution, she said, does not write a blank check to the president, not even in time of war. Ah, yeah. Pretty high level of abstraction, those words. And you're immediately thinking, as is the questioner, okay, what kind of check does it write? Now, our opinions in those cases have been pretty criticized. There are those who think, no, you shouldn't have gotten into this business at all. To which I reply, and I think the opinion is basic. Korematsu, you want to go down that road? Do we go back to Korematsu? Not too many want that. Well, the others say on the other side, well, why didn't you give us a bit of a better list? Why did you just so cautious? Why didn't you go out there and say you can't do this, you can do the other thing, but not this? And true answer to that is I haven't a clue what the list should be. I don't know, nor do I think anybody on the courts knows, really. None of us know. We don't know quite what the future holds. But I think in developing that list, in my own reaction, I think that of many judges, is caution, please. This is not something that has clear answers. It is not something that we know exactly what's going to work and what isn't. It is an area which is universal. It's all over the world. And we're not the only country to have these problems, and we're not the only country with democratic values. So why don't we see what others are doing, too? Why don't we see, learn something about the nature of this threat, which it is? And why don't we develop answers, call it the method of the common law, slowly, over time, see how it works, and learn as you go, and learn not just from our experience here, but learn from experience elsewhere as well. You see why I like the question?
Yep.
And the questioner doesn't particularly like my answer because it isn't specific because I can't give a specific answer.
Let's hear from our audience over here at Haynes and Boone.
Okay, yeah, I have a question on affirmative action. The vast majority of my Chinese friends voted for Trump because they believed that under the Trump administration, with the help of his Supreme Court nominee or nominees, that they are going to end affirmative action in college admission. So I'm interested to know, what do you think of this?
The odd thing about a judge, which people never believe, is when you say to such a question, it's an excellent question, I really don't know what will happen. The odd thing is that that's actually true. I really don't know what will happen. We have our opinions, their precedent. I joined the opinion of the majority in the last affirmative action case. And it says what it says, you know. It gives certain rules. This came out of Texas. And we've had several cases on it. And whoever comes in will have to face that authority and decide what it means, da-da-da. You see, I'm now just talking in generalities because I try not to think about what one person in politics or another part of the government might or might not do. That isn't the job. You say, what is the job? Not that. Well, I think the job works best. If you want the best, what I found is the best description of it, you go back to Tocqueville, who really was a genius. He's here in 1840, and among many other things, he says whenever he comes over to America, the first thing he hears is the clamor. And what he means by the clamor, everybody talking, lots of different views. How do we decide things in the areas, for example, that question? Affirmative action has been around for a while, but let's try privacy and the First Amendment. Well, we talk about it. People have different views. They write articles. The law school professors debate it. There are op-eds. There are the Sheriff's Association might have a view. The intelligence organizations might. There may be all kinds of meetings. There may be now internet discussions. And eventually, we might try out certain things try it out, didn't work, let's go back. Maybe an administrative ruling, maybe we change the administrative ruling. Maybe there's a Senate hearing or something and eventually a law comes up, maybe they change that and eventually it sort of settles down and this is what it is. And it's at that point when if we do our job best that we come in last. Because our job is not to tell people what the answer to those questions is. This document does not tell people, very rarely does it give people answers. What it does is it sketches out a framework for a certain kind of government. It's a government that is based on democracy, that protects certain human rights, that divides power vertically and horizontally, three branches, state, federal, so no one becomes too powerful. It assures a degree of equality, a certain degree, and it insists upon a rule of law. And the rest flows from that. But those are border conditions. They're creating a frontier. And our job is primarily, John Stevens used to say this all the time, and nobody really believed it, but it's true. We're mostly deciding not whether this is good or bad, but who has the power to decide? Where does this document place the power to make this kind of decision? What are the boundaries? And life is sometimes difficult at the frontier. I know that because when I was 8 years old, I used to listen to Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. He was up there in Canada. It was really cold, a lot colder than here, and life was tough. Okay, abortion, inside, outside. Affirmative action. To what extent? Where? Under what circumstances? If ever. Prayer in schools. I mean, some of these border conditions, inside or outside. And they're hard. And normally, there are two sides to it, which no one believes. But there are. And there are good arguments on both sides. Now, the mistake that people make, and I think this is a bad mistake, is they extrapolate from the fact that there are difficult border cases, this side or that side, that I've talked to you about. They extrapolate from that that we're deciding far too much, that we're deciding how people should live. No. What the document does, it places decisions about how our cities, towns, states, nations should live in the hands of the citizen. And that's not a cliche. That's the truth. That's what it does. And that's why I say to the students, this document foresees you participating in the public life of your city, town, state, nation. You can be on the school board. You can go and run for library commissioner. You can do 1,000 different things. You can get into politics. But please do something. Because what it does say to me, and probably to most of us, if you don't participate, this document won't work. And this is a document that has held this very diverse group of 320 million people together over a very long period of time. A tremendous asset.
Let's take one more question from the audience.
Thank you, sir. Jim said something earlier about terrorism. You mentioned that when the cannons are roaring, the president has a lot more authority. Would it be your personal opinion that our present situation with the terrorist threat, the cannons are roaring, or they're not roaring at this time?
Could be. So I didn't hear the end.
At this current time, would you say that the cannons are roaring, or are they not roaring?
It's one of the questions, isn't it? The war against terror. What we had in our four cases is we had a war in Afghanistan. And when we decided that the president did have authority to intern those who were enemy combatants in Guantanamo, we put in, this was Sandra O'Connor's opinion, she said this is a war in Afghanistan that is an ordinary war. That is to say, there are two groups of forces and they are fighting each other, as in World War II. We're not saying anything about what happens where there is no such ordinary war, where there are different conditions and different circumstances. So we have not yet had the case that would answer your question. You say, why don't I comment anyway? Because I have some caution.
Good. I'd like to introduce Adam Agu. Would you please come up, council member from the city of Dallas, to make a special presentation. First of all, go ahead.
Is it working? Okay. First of all, thank you, Jim. Thank you, World Affairs Council, for allowing me to be here. And may it please the court, Justice Breyer. This has been a wonderful, wonderful discussion. And on behalf of the mayor and the entire city council, our city has purchased a number of your books, and we're going to make sure that they're in our libraries. Libraries are going to be in District 10, the district I represent, at the Forest Green Library and at Audelia Road Library. And so we are honored to be able to do that, and I'm honored to welcome you to Dallas, and we hope you come back many more times. We've already forgotten what happened on Sunday, so we're going to give you credit for starting the new Cowboys winning streak moving forward. And finally, on behalf of my kids who pay attention and have learned over this last year a lot more about politics, both with my service and with another election kind of going on around here, we are a family that prays for our leaders, and we include our justices of the Supreme Court. And so on behalf of Noah Cooper and Eli Magu, thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Couldn't be nicer. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam. Good to see you. Now, one thing you may not know, Your Honor, is that the World Affairs Council is the only council out of 90 in the country that has a cycling club. And I know that you ride a bicycle, sometimes outside, sometimes inside.
Sometimes well, sometimes badly.
We're all like that. So allow me to present you with the official World Affairs Council
fabulous.
Cycling.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, Justice Stephen Breyer.
Thank you.
Great being with you, sir.
Well, thank you.
Have a good trip. Merry Christmas, everyone. Happy holidays. See you next year.